Accession number 13138, reel 1.
Mr. Crawley, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Hull, well, on the outskirts. I think just outside it in those days because they wanted the boundaries.
Which year was that?
1915, August 1915.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a manure merchant last time his last job while I know him. And he had a place at the bottom of Ringrose Street there. It was a few acres, but it'd been all brick ponds, you know, and I think he rented this off, I think it was LNER Railway, you see, and he was a sort of caretaker, so it was a cheap job, and also facilities there for storing all his manure, you know.
Did you go to school in Hull?
Yes, I went to St George's Road School in Hull.
How old were you when you left?
14.
Did you get a job?
14. Well, I did get a job. I had a job at Thompson's Garage, sweeping up sort of thing. I had a job with a boot repairer. But I spent a lot of the time running around on the fish dock, you know, and got to know people on there. Well, all those lads from that area, we always got down on the fish dock, and I think it was always our ambition to go to sea, but I finished up joining the Navy. I was about 15 and a couple of months when I went to the Ganges.
Why did you decide to go in for the Royal Navy?
Don't know, it must have seemed easy. With all those people on the ship. Yeah.
Was it easy to get accepted for shortly?
No, not really. In those days, there was quite a lot of unemployed, and they were a bit. There were people outside of the recruiting office who were disappointed that they couldn't get in, you know. And I think it was a matter of having a job.
What was the training like in 1930-31 at Shotley?
Well, for instance, you got there and you had this big mast 200 foot high up to the truck, you see, and you had to go over it in 3 minutes over the rigging, and you took one look at this mast. It was terrifying, but you took one look at the instructor and that was also terrifying, so you went over the mast. But I actually ran away from there one night, two of us anyhow.
Why?
And, well, it was after running round as I had done, it was so much, like, restricted and anyhow, we had the idea of going up to Ipswich. We went up to Ipswich and we hiked one night through the forest on the the banks of the Orwell. The Orwell was the river, I think. We come to a place called Pin Mill. We slept in a boat and the tide came up and it was lapping the edges of the boat, floated the boat. So when we woke up, let go and rowed across the river. we were in a big deer park across there when the detectives got us and took us back to Felixstowe and then back aboard the Ganges, for which we had 12 cuts with the cane administered, and a further 12 cuts in 3 days' time, and 14 days running round the parade ground with a rifle.
How were the cuts administered?
Oh, a bit barbaric, really. They were over a vaulting horse, you know, a vaulting horse, and at four corners of the vaulting horse there was a canvas lashing, and as you went in this cell where they administered the cuts, you had a pair of duck trousers on, next to your skin, you see. And these RPOs, regulating petty officers, grabbed you and flung you over this vaulting horse and lashed your hands down there and your ankles was down the other side. So you was taut. And then the commander and everybody was there. And then the master at arms counted out the cuts very slow, well, not very slowly, but quite good spacing, like 1, 2, 3, and then they inspected you to see there was no damage or the skin wasn't broken or anything, and that was it.
Did it hurt?
Yes, it was pretty terrific. It was, of course, I think, I don't know when it was stopped, but it was a rather barbaric capital punishment, you know.
Corporal punishment?
Corporal punishment, yes, yes.
Do you think you deserved it?
Well, by those rules of those days, I suppose that would be all that would apply. But today, administering a young person, subjecting a young person to that kind of treatment would sound pretty barbaric.
Did you feel bitter about being punished in that way?
Well, I don't know. I suppose you did, but I never got on in the Navy after that. Well, I seem to be... in trouble, like, for small things, you know, and probably if I hadn't had that on my record, I would have been... got on better with it, you see.
Do you think you were a marked man because of it?
Well, you tend to be a marked man, you know, you could... The Master of Arms and all them, they... I suppose when you join a ship, they look at your papers and you're noted for this kind of thing.
Had you intended to stay away from HMS Ganges or to come back?
Oh, definitely, just to stay away. Like,
you'd had enough? We had
a fantastic idea of joining some fair, gypsy fair at Ipswich, but it was crazy, you know.
Was there a gypsy fair at Ipswich?
There was, yes. At the time... Yeah.
Whose idea was it? Was it your idea to run away, or was it your friend's?
Well, we discussed it. Well, it seemed to be that different people have run away from this Ganges, and they kept bringing them back, you know, at odd times. And it seemed to be sort of competitive, you know, that. To compete in this race sort of thing.
To run away?
Yes. But one chap I know, he was from Hong Kong as well, and he had it, what was his name? He had a double barrel name, anyhow. Robinson Kelly, I think. And he'd been missing for 6 months, and he came back while we were in the cells waiting to be weighed off, sort of thing.
Weighed off?
Well, tried, you know.
So, why were they all running away?
Well, they weren't. It wasn't as many as that. It was odd ones running away, but for the same reason. I think the discipline of it, you know, and if you weren't sort of used to that discipline, I think it rankled a bit. But the people who got on better, the young boys who got on better in the Ganges were the lads who came from these training ships, the Arethusa, and different training schools all over the country, who were in lots of cases orphans and things like that. But they got on very well, you see. So they were used to a regime like that, I think.
What was there about the regime or the discipline at Shotley that you particularly didn't like?
Well, I couldn't really say. I can't point anything out specifically. It was the whole thing, I think. And having been so free before going there, it was a bit of a shock, you know.
Do you think that being at HMS Ganges did you any good?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes, yeah. I learnt a lot of seamanship, and I mean, we used to sail boats and sail the cutters and that in races and all that. I learnt a lot. Yes, and of course, I carried on my schooling as well, which was finished at 14, but I was able to carry on my schooling as well, which I'd later carried on at sea as well in HMS Durban. But yes, there's quite a lot of good came out of it. I got all my teeth fixed as well, like. And
in what way?
Well, they'd been neglected, you know. People didn't bother about the teeth much in those days. And they had dentists there, and they filled all the teeth that needed filling. And so, yes, I regard the seamanship and the handling boats and things like that, and rowing boats and all that, and the gym and all that, it was very good.
Now, you left HMS Ganges after about a year.
I think it was about 8 months, I think.
And went into the Navy proper. Did you just go in as an ordinary seaman?
No, he was in the Navy proper. You see, you joined up as a boy to do 12 years, but the 12 years didn't start until you was 18. So that meant you were 30 when you finished your 12 years. But the 15 and a quarter, I think it was, the age when you could join. And that's when I joined. And, of course, that boys' time didn't count, although you was in the Navy proper. And from there I went to join the HMS Durban.
On the seaman's side?
Seaman, by seaman.
What kind of a ship was HMS Durban?
She was a what we'd call a light cruiser built in the First World War. And she was and the Commodore South America. Like, we do a commission out there. We did 2.5 years out there, commission. And I was promoted to ordinary seaman while I was there. I did pass, actually, a test that further embittered me. I passed a test for accelerated advancement. They called it the AA test. And you put you 6 months in advance for a rating of ordinary seamen. Instead of being rated at 18, you was rated at 17 and a half. And when I passed this test, education and various and seamanship and that. And I came up for the Commodore to be promoted, and he said he was far too young to be promoted. And so I didn't get promoted, unfairly. I thought it was very unfair. And of course that further embittered me.
So you felt a sense of grievance against the Navy?
Well, against individuals in the Navy, I suppose. And I suppose the rules. You know, a rather funny happening because of that. After they wouldn't rate me, being a young lad, was talking about getting to Bermuda, and the CNC comes aboard at Bermuda, and there's a ship inspection, you see, and you falls out men for kit inspection, and I was one of them. But talking to all the crew, they said, "Oh, we're all going to see the CNC. You get a chance to see the CNC at Bermuda after inspection of the ship." So I thought, "Well, that'd be a good idea. I'll see the CNC to see about this." So anyhow, after the kit inspection, we had exercises and inspection by the CNC. He was a fellow, Lord Ernley L. Plunkett Drax or something they called him. And after the exercises and that, it says that all men wishing to see the CNC lay aft. So I trotted aft. When I got up there, there was all the gold braid in the Navy all round. And I was the only one. Boy seaman. However, the CNC said, well, you'll be put on trial, and if you're satisfactory, you'll be promoted, which nobody took any notice of further than that. Like, I wasn't promoted, so I still lost that 6 months.
Now, you were telling me earlier that you deserted ship, HMS Glorious,
yes,
in Egypt in 1935.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how and why that came about?
Well, it was, I suppose, a general discontent. I was boat's crew, motorboat's crew, you see, and it was a time of Italy's invasion of Ethiopia, when they let the Italians through the Suez Canal. And, well, we didn't... We thought they shouldn't allow them to go through, but that had nothing to do with it, really. But we'd been ashore one night. See, the ship used to do flying exercises off Alex during the day and during the week, and come in at weekend. Well, down went the motorboat at weekend, and the motorboat's crew were ferrying people ashore and back, and we did hardly got any time off. As much as the other people, anyhow. And, however, myself and this Taft, called him, I forget whether his name was Wise or Wiseman, another chap of the boat's crew, and we went ashore, we came back and were on board, and there was an argument or something, and so we packed a few things in a bag and shinned out. Oh, this is the one time she was alongside the quay. This is why we weren't in the boat. And
who was the argument with?
Well, I think it was one of the leading seamen in the mess or something. I just forget. So we packed a few things in a bag and what I thought we'd need, and she was alongside a catamaran, so we just went over the side. Instead of going near the gangway where the night watchman was and the corporal of the guard, like, sort of thing, climbed down the side of the ship and walked right into the dockyard. And that's where we were for about 3 weeks.
How did you survive?
Well, we used to go on board merchant ships and bum our food, you know. But you see, in those days, that Alexander, they had a big coal quay there, you know. They export a lot of coal, particularly from South Wales, from Cardiff and Barry Docks and that. Well, it was a bunkering station. Well, you can imagine most of the shipping in those days were coal-fired steamships, you know. And they used to come up through the Suez Canal from the colonies, from the Indian Ocean, from China, the East. And they all wanted bunkers by the time they got to the canal, the Suez or Portside or Alex, you see. And they used to come in alongside that coal quay. So it was very hive of activity in those days. Whereas today I don't know what it'd be like. It'd be very quiet, I suppose. So we knew all the Arabs on the coal quay. We used to stop and have tea with these Arabs. You know, the Sahida Effendi, he'd give us a shout, like, every morning, and... Oh, it was all right.
Did they know that you'd deserted ship?
They thought we'd missed a British cargo ship, you see. And there's quite a few incidents there, which were very, very amusing. We fell asleep in a railway wagon one night. And all of a sudden they started shunting it. And Taft said, we might finish up in Cairo. Anyhow, all of a sudden there's a light flashing, and we jumped up, and there was a fella perched on a high platform waving the hurricane lamp sort of thing to the train driver who was shunting it, giving him signals, and he fell right from the top. Oh, crikey, and we jumped out the wagon and run. But were pretty well known. One of the watchmen there, Muhammad, he came to us one time and he said, would you do me a favour? I said, well, what is it? So apparently, this one of the donkey men on one of the cargo ships had been robbed by this Mustafa, the bumboat man, for 5 shillings. So Muhammad had gone to the donkey man and said, write me out a letter to the chief of police and I'll take it to my Mustafa, and if he doesn't give me the 5 shillings, I'll chop him from the chief of police and get him off the dock. So I went and showed this to Mustafa, and Mustafa grabbed it and tore it all up into shreds. When he got to know us, like, he said, would we piece this letter together, you see? So we went to his house one night and pieced all this jigsaw together, and he wrote it out afresh, and he got his 5 shillings.
Because you were better at English than he was.
Well, he didn't know much about English at all.
So, really, you deserted ship because you thought you were overworked?
No, not really, no. It's, once again, I wouldn't pin it down to that. I suppose it was... it was something, I don't know. It certainly wasn't a studied or planned thing, because we'd have been more prepared if it had been planned, you see. But we just did it on the spur of the moment. But we had to get out of there, you see, because, of course, Alexander was under British rule at the time. And we used to get aboard these Levantese Latin ships. What did they call them? Latin rig they had. Cakes, was it?
Kikes.
Kikes or something like that.
Dows?
No, they were kikes.
Kikes.
Used to bring these... the cedars of Lebanon, timber they used to bring into Wallax. We used to, these Levantines, being, they liked you because they were British, the Levantines, and we used to get aboard for a yarn, you know. And I'm sure we could have got a job with them there, with the sails. But that to declare us for leaving Alexandria, you see, through the British authorities, was, you know, good. So anyhow, we found out there's this Euphelia Marie, I've mentioned it. Them in there, a Greek ship called the Euphelia Marie was going to the UK. So on the day she was supposed to sail, the night she was supposed to sail, of the next day, we went aboard on the boat deck, just uncovered the cover of the lifeboat, and two of us crawled into the lifeboat.
As stowaways?
As stowaways, you see. So we said we knew she was going to the UK. We said, our intention was to go there and give ourselves up after a couple of days out of Alex, you see. But after a couple of days on biscuits and water in the boat, out the boat's provisions, we said, we'll give up if we can't stick any more. So we lived on biscuits and water, and you can imagine that low cover and the oars and all the paraphernalia of lifeboat. And those Greeks, I always remember them washing the davits, and we could see them through the tin canvas cover. And I thought, hell, if they uncover this, it'll shock them. But they never did a boat drill or anything. And we used to, of course, the toilet facilities, we used to use the bucket to urinate, but we didn't do the other thing because I suppose we were not eating much. And when we, at times, in the night, we'd whip the cover up and throw the urine over the side. And then we called into Algiers. We knew it was Algiers because we'd see the names on the stern of the tug, Al-Alga. A couple of days in Algiers and then carried on. And we're still laid stretched. We unlashed the cover, the sail off the cover, and it'd be coming the colder weather, and wrapped ourselves up in this. And I remember we had the lifeboat's cover on the weather side propped up with a matchstick, or you could spot the Gibraltar and that as we went through. And good camps, crossing of the bay it was. Went down the London River, and we didn't know, but we docked at Rotherhithe. I didn't know it was Rotherhithe until we got in the pub, like. But we were still in this boat, and as soon as it got dark, we got out of the boat and we fell down, both fell down. Our muscles, would not go to. And yeah, we staggered over the gangway like a couple of drunken seamen. And the cop on the gate at Rotherhithe said good night to us. And we made it. And
without the crew detecting you?
Well, I've often thought since, if anybody, if they'd known we was in there and they'd left it, I don't think they'd take that chance. Because, you know, when a ship gets saddled with a stowaway, you can't get rid of them anywhere, you know. Mind, in our case, they would have done in London, but who's to know that? And I thought, I wonder if they know we're here and they're leaving us, and so that they don't have any problems. I mean, if we, they would have had problems if we, if we'd have given ourselves up and British, it would have been merely a matter of handing us over to the authorities. We would, because we were British. But if they were foreigners, they would have put those foreigners in jail while the ship sailed and then put them back on the ship. Say, that's your problem, away. You see? But I don't think they can have known. And we, when we went up to the, in Rotherhithe, there was a cafe, you know, like a docker's cafe there. We went in and we ordered bacon and eggs, like, and cups of cocoa, and the lady who was, it was a late night, the lady who was operating it said, oh, it'll be a while. So there was a pub a couple of doors away, so we went and had a pint. And the barman said, brother, he said, you look as if you had a rough passage. Because this Welsh coal, you know, gets everywhere, you know, the dust of the Welsh coal, fine. And in the boat, we were black, absolutely black. And anyhow, we went back to the cafe, and a little girl running and shouting, "Mummy, there's those two tramps back again." Now we caught the underground from there and proceeded up to Paddington Station, because we thought if we get there, they had an underground bath system there, with baths and that. We could get a bath, you see, and when we got there, the attendant wasn't going to let us in for a bath. Anyhow, we finally bribed him, and we got a bath and got cleaned up. And just from the Paddington Station, I think you call it Little Street, I think, there's a Salvation Army place, and we went and stayed there. We stayed there about maybe a couple of weeks, I think, till we got there. We had some money, and we had a tin of tobacco and things. We had razors and things like that. But we stayed in the Salvation Army until we got our walking muscles back and were performing normally again. And then we came up, went up to Hull, and he left, and I think he went home to Bristol. We called him Taff, but he lived in Bristol, where he was a Taffer originally. And I went down to Fishtock, and